Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. And now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, other stuff, fun comments directed at me at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, it's the Danger Pixie Actual, Melody Lauer.
Hello!
Hey, it's season 6.
It is already.
That's kind of cool.
It is kind of cool, actually.
So I'm kind of excited. Some new stuff, some old stuff.
Wait, what's new?
I mean, Surefire's the title sponsor. That's pretty cool.
That's true. That is true. I just didn't know if there's anything like new that I didn't know about yet. It had happened.
Yes, I'm going to tell you the new stuff live on air. It's a surprise.
That would not be new.
No, I guess that wouldn't be. So. Hey, guess what?
What's that?
This segment brought to you by Lucky Gunner and Federal Premium Ammunition. Whether there was a firefight or you do, in fact, want to worry about that little guy, you need more ammo. And when it's time to restock, you can't beat Federal Premium Ammunition and LuckyGunner.com. With a shipping department that's always moving at 88 miles per hour, if I order a case of American Eagle from Lucky Gunner on a Thursday, it's at my doorstep, ready to shoot before the weekend starts. I like how I said Thursday. I don't know why. Head to LuckyGunner.com today to check out their in-stock lineup of Federal Premium Ammunition. And remember, unless you're on fire or drowning, you can never really have too much ammo. So here's one thing I am really excited about. John Hearn is going to be joining us in just 1 second. Actually, as soon as I press the button, hopefully I don't hang up on him because we've not done a live show in just a little bit. And I'm kind of shaky on how the phones work, so
I'm thinking when the last one it was not too terribly long ago though.
Yeah. So anyway, joining us, John Hearn. John, how's it going?
Man, I'm doing great tonight. How about you guys?
Oh, I can't complain. So what's new with you?
Just keep plodding along. I am in lovely the wilds of Alabama. Soon to be joined with our favorite chief deputy for a shooting class over the next couple of days. So I'm looking forward to that.
Nice. For those that don't know, our favorite chief deputy would be Lee Weems, who is awesome and amazing and just a lot of good, wholesome fun. So I like how we can occasionally educate him on things like vernacular at dinner.
Oh, God, yes.
But we're not going to go there right now. For those that don't know, man, you've been on the show a couple of times, but it's been a little bit. Who are you? What do you do? And we'll hop right into tonight's slaughtering of sacred cows. Melody has just got a look on her face like, oh, man, he already went there.
All right. So break this down real quickly. I've been a law enforcement officer since 1992, teach a bunch of the force stuff for my agency. More significantly, I've been teaching firearms with Tom Givens since around 2001. I think the last time I checked, I'm at about 1,500 hours of professional training, a lot of it at the instructor level. Along the way, I picked up a master's degree, what I call a real master's degree, where I went through the whole thesis process, got published in a peer-reviewed article, that sort of thing. I've been speaking and researching in the gun world since around 2005, write a little bit here and there. I would say more importantly for tonight's show, I have a lot of very strong nerd and research tendencies and a very understanding wife that allows that to happen. And I'd say most recently I've been digging into human performance under life and death stress and trying to figure out how we make that work for us.
Well, when you say most recently, you've been working on this for a hot minute now, haven't you?
Yeah, I have this horrible tendency of coming up with these quick projects that I'll knock out, and like 2 or 3 years later, I'm still slogging through it. The other issue with this is that the real problem we've had in the past is that people kind of freeze their research once they have the answer. And I've worked really hard to keep out there reading, researching, trying to make sure I haven't missed anything or there haven't been any significant changes along the way. So it keeps you on your toes.
Well, that actually kind of segues nicely because it seems like, in full disclosure, I've sat through I have been present for and riveted by your presentation multiple times now. But one of the things that you talk about, and I'd kind of like to start here, is the problems with, I guess, the traditional research and how it gets applied to what we do.
Well, there's two issues there. First off, there's a very common book, Sharpening the Warrior's Edge, that is still used by a lot of people as a touchstone for this stuff. And the problem with that book is it was originally published in 1995, which means he probably had to stop, researching it around 93 or so. And what we now know 20 years later is that a lot of that stuff in that book is just simply inaccurate and very pessimistic about what people can do under stress. And then we also have, some of the results from that is we have studies that were really, really old that don't really necessarily apply directly to our world that have been, we've tried to stick in there and show some correlations, whether those correlations are there or not.
So why do you think that is, or what causes that, I guess?
Well, there's several factors driving that. Number one, I think there's for lack of a better word, a really strong bias among academia that really don't want to study how people who are able to basically, kill criminals are able to do it more effectively. That's just not a very popular topic at universities. And also part of it is just a fundamental, a misunderstanding of the nature of human violence and what it takes to succeed as well.
Well, so what do you think? We got about 3 minutes left in this segment, but what do you think some of the, and we'll get into some other topics as well, but what do you think some of the fundamental misunderstandings are as far as human violence and how we get good at that, for lack of a better term?
So there's a couple of things I would say are like some relevant key points. I think one of the biggest things I found in my research was that we tend to miss this concept of recency, which is how often it has been since you last practiced something. And one of the things that we find when we dig through the research as well as look at people who have performed well, people who perform well have spent a good amount of their life preparing for that moment, and they've also practiced those skills fairly recently. So they're kind of at the top of our mind when we get under stress. The brain tends to grab whatever's closest by. And because they've practiced that stuff more recently, it's more readily accessible. And to me, one of just the biggest, mythology out there is that you can't perform under stress, that you'll become this quivering mass of jello when the flag flies. And there's a lot of strong evidence to the contrary there, both, research-wise and, a lot of anecdotal evidence, from the world, whether we're talking about Jim Cirillo or, Uncle Scotty Reed, stuff like that. There's clearly people that are able to do this when it counts.
Well, and that's always been kind of interesting to me, just because, I have friendly disagreements with people that you and I both know about, unless it's caught on video, you can't take someone's anecdotal word for things. And I'm like, well, I understand where that's coming from. But I'm also friends with people that have done this, into the double, sometimes triple digits with some of the people I know. And their experience does not necessarily mirror the theories of some individuals. Do you think that all just comes back to recency and how often people practice that stuff? We've got about 70 seconds left in this segment.
Well, recency is a big part of it, but it also has to do with what mind, for lack of a better word, those people tend to be focusing in. One of the things I make a really strong argument for is that we have an emotional mind and a rational mind. And the people that are able to perform this well under stress are functioning much more on the emotional, much more on the rational side of their brain. They, the fact that someone might be trying to kill them really isn't a shock to their psyche. They've got a plan to deal with it, and they're able to execute that, as opposed to the person who didn't really had never internalized that somebody might try to kill them. They've done nothing to prepare for it, and all of a sudden when they're confronted with that threat, they've got nothing to deliver. So, yeah, that's going to go really poorly for the second person we described. And it tends to go pretty good for the first one we described.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. See, you should have just strung that out like 10 more seconds, John, and it would have been perfect for hitting my break. But I guess I'll just have to fill in with meaningless blabber for like another 2 seconds. Hey, look, I did it. So we're talking with John Hearn about performance under stress and sacred cows and stuff like that. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the new EDC X9, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match-grade accuracy, superior ergonomics and concealability with modern service pistol capacity and reliability at www.wilsoncombat.com. So, it's season six, and we are joined by John Hearn. And before the break, John, we didn't really make anyone mad yet, I don't think. But I think that we should hop into that, don't you?
Always, man. Let's go for it.
Okay. So one of the big sort of like buzzwords, and I actually was at a state mandated training class this last week that was, interesting. But one of the things that that I hear either online or even in this class was sort of like this homeopathic concept of natural or instinctive or intuitive. Are there any problems with that when we start talking about self-defense based around a firearm?
Well, absolutely. It's not just based around a firearm. It's self-defense taking place within a legal context as well.
Okay.
So there's this whole argument out there that we have to find the natural ways to do something. And I would, politely suggest that perhaps the best way to pee yourself and run away from a threat, the natural way to do that probably has some value. The problem is we are using non-natural tools. And whether anytime we're in a life and death crisis, whether it's someone at the end of our gun or we have experienced a scuba emergency at 100 feet below the water, if we try to implement those classic natural solutions when we're facing non-natural problems, we're going to die a horrible screaming death. You have gotten yourself in a place where your highly developed mind has gotten you, and it's going to take that highly developed mind to get you out of there. So the natural response, arguably very much is to void your bladder, run away, screaming, but that really doesn't solve the problem that's confronting us. Also, again, I mentioned earlier that legal context is what you might want to naturally do to someone is not what you should probably do legally to that person, at least if you're interested in staying out of prison and avoiding the whole criminal justice experience.
Right, right.
Well, I mean, a technical point, you can't die screaming underwater because you can't scream without air passing through your vocal cords.
You can attempt to scream.
You can. You'll get a little bit out.
I think you get a brief scream with whatever air is in those lungs, and
then you're done. Sorry, continue.
You realize that what I'm going to do is fill my bathtub up later, stick my head under the water, and try and yell into the water to see whether or not you can, in fact. And I think I'm going to win this.
You can until you get water and you're.
Yeah, anyway. Tangential. So you're suggesting that perhaps our natural inclination to, when encountered via a predator that we don't feel able to deal with, to run away is perhaps not helpful. Or not always helpful or can you elaborate on that?
Well, running away might be really useful in certain circumstances. The problem is especially with when we're talking about the handgun or any kind of, essentially firearm, it requires something that almost nothing else we've ever done is, which is I've got to focus on, the front sight if I really want to hit at it. Mm-hmm. So I could, in theory, stick my pistol out and convulsively, crank on the trigger until I go to slide lock and hope for the best. But history has shown us that hope is a suboptimal survival strategy.
Right.
If I want to use that handgun to the fullest, I've got to keep my rational mind engaged, try to find, at least, somehow visually align the weapon with the threat and press it until the threat stops. And more importantly, once the threat stops, stop pressing the trigger to avoid the unpleasant legal issues.
Well, so I guess when people start talking about this in a self-defense context, and they start talking about it as far as, natural shooting methods or things like that. How long does it take for a natural or instinctive behavior to develop inside of an organism, I guess, evolutionarily?
I'm not sure I'm quite tracking, but basically, the theory is that if something is innate or natural, we don't have to develop. We come kind of hardwired to do it already. And none of us come, not even Tom Gibbons, came out of the womb shooting.
Well, so, I guess what I was asking was, how many thousands or tens of thousands of years of evolution does it take for something to become hardwired at the instinctive level? And well, you kind of got where I was going with that, is that guns haven't been around that long. But
yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, modern, what we think of as, you know, modern hominids, for lack of a better word, everything that's basically human. Yeah, we've been around for probably 2.5 million years, depending on which paleoanthropology you dig into. So just on the human side of this stuff, we've been doing, carrying on in what we call those would be primary emotions, flight, fright, freeze, or posture. They've been around for a long time. The problem is those are not always our best options. And if we're going to do something other than those four things, we have to work to replace our natural responses with something that's more relevant.
Okay. Why do you think so many people get hung up on the natural response or thing? I mean, is that just like a marketing tool, or is there research that's been misconstrued, or what's the deal there?
I think it's a combination of things. I think a lot of it just comes down to marketing. We know, I think almost all of us know anyway, that there is no magic skinny pill that you can take. We all know that if you want to lose weight and get into shape, you have to watch what goes into your mouth, maybe do some pushbacks from the table, and do some exercise. Yet somehow there's always this market for somebody that says, hey, man, I've got an easy way for you. All you have to do is this. So I think a lot of the people that are pushing the natural stuff are really trying to sell you something. Mm-hmm. And by trying to sell you that, what they're really doing is lying to you and hiding the reality that you're going to have to do some work if you want to do this stuff well.
Well, and do you think that there's – so this is something I kind of struggle with, but and maybe it's just a base assumption that some trainers have versus other trainers. I know which camp I fall into, but – unfortunately, a lot of self-defense encounters are won just by sucking less than the other dude. It's not that you're really any good. It's just that the other dude or dudette is so awful that you don't have to be super good. And it's kind of like the base assumption that anything someone teaches them is not going to matter that much because you just, you know, have to suck less. But the other side of it, and this is kind of where, you know, I know you and I agree on this, or at least I think we do, that if we're going to plan for a bad day, plan for a bad day. Do you think that plays into it, or?
Well, I think we need to distinguish between winning your confrontation and surviving your confrontation.
Ooh, good one.
A lot of the guys that suck less than their opponents, you know, the classic example is one guy that's been in a gunfight, and yeah, he dumped a magazine at the bad guy dumped a magazine at him, and they both ran away. Well, he didn't win that fight. You know, when you plant your front sight in the middle of somebody's chest, track him as he's moving and press the trigger straight to the back, and there's a bullet hole right there, that guy won his fight. And we can definitely, Cirillo would be the obvious example. So I distinguish between merely surviving an encounter and winning the encounter. And we want to win the encounter. We want to dominate it. You know, the whole idea of establishing the dominance paradigm, to use that great class.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to just barely survive. You know, the theme in law enforcement, you know, for years has been, you know, Christopher Reeves survived that fall off of the horse, but he certainly didn't win.
Yeah.
So our goal needs to not to be to survive, but we need to win and do so in a dominating fashion.
Well,
and we do that by engaging our rational minds.
Well, and that's kind of, we got 2 minutes left in the segment, but for you specifically, when you say engaging the rational mind, in 2 minutes or less, what exactly does that mean for you, and what do you want people to take away from that?
So the argument could be made that we kind of have two separate minds. We have a lower mind where, for lack of a better word, the reptilian brain lies, the mammalian brain lies, and that's where our emotions really lie, our primary responses of fight, flight, freeze, or posture. What we've been able to do through the course of evolution is we've added this great thing to our mind called the neocortex. The neocortex is what gives us all of our speech abilities, our ability to live in social groups, all the advantages we think of as human. And those two parts of the brain are always going to be in conflict when survival is at stake. So you've got your subconscious that's sitting there all the time trying to figure out whether it trusts the rational mind or the emotional mind to solve the problem. And typically, as soon as death is on the line, to quote a great movie, all of a sudden the emotional mind becomes a lot more appealing. So what we almost have to do is to train the subconscious to trust that rational mind to say, hey, I see the guy coming across the parking lot on the intercept course. I've planned for this. You know, I've planned for this. We have contingencies. We're going to go okay, as opposed to resorting to fight, flight, freeze, or posture, which in a projectile-based world never works out well for us.
Well, and it seems like that all sort of circles back around to the how seriously people are taking the actual threat of violence done to them. I mean, we got like 20 seconds left, but is that kind of what it comes back to? Is that people either really believe it could possibly happen or really at the back of their head don't?
I think that a lot of this comes from a lack of understanding and a denial of the realities of violence that we actually face out there. It's huge because if it's not real, you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, let me interrupt. We got to go to break. We're talking with John Hearn. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. This segment also brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it, and that's where Surefire comes in. From the new 1200 lumen EDCL 2T handheld or 500 lumen EDCL 1T handheld to the 1000 lumen XH35 or the soon-to-be-released 1500 lumen M600DF Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, Aziz Light, ever again. Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. And now is a special offer to Ballistic Radio listeners. You can get 20% off everything at the Surefire.com web store, except suppressors and batteries, by entering the discount code AZIZLIGHT. That is AZIZLIGHT, no space. So anyway, we're talking with John Hearn, and we were sort of discussing people's misunderstanding of violence and what that actually looks like and stuff like that. You were kind of, and I had to interrupt you, but you were kind of saying people just really misunderstand the entire thing.
Well, I think that people don't appreciate that violence remains a possibility in the world. We have a lot of people that, you know, live in this artificial construct in which they're insulated from the raping and the robbing and the murdering, and they're convinced that that happens to other people. Well, if those are problems that either barely exist anymore or certainly happen to other people, you don't have to do very much to prepare for them. I can assure you some of the most motivated students you will ever teach or interact with are the ones who have, in fact, experienced violence either directly or indirectly as part of their existence. It really brings it home and, you know, makes it important to them. You know, we also are in this weird cultural time where we've begun to assume that anything violent is automatically bad. And I would make a very compelling argument that, you know, we should be supporting this idea of pro-social violence, which is the idea that if we, you know, of lawful moral violence in the service of good is not a bad thing. You know, if bad things happen to bad people, that's not a tragedy. That's the way it should be. And the whole world is better off when there are immediate consequences to trying to rob, rape, and murder folks.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like, too, that so I've I try and have conversations with people that don't necessarily agree with me on a fairly regular basis, just because I think it's a good way to have a better understanding of, and I don't like using the term sides, but what the other side thinks. And it seems like there's this massive disconnect between the idea that sometimes violence is a good thing for us and society. It's not something that we want to seek out, but it can certainly be useful for utilizing or finding ways to sort of deal with situations, I guess, that you can't deal with any other way.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole, you know, bridge or dam you've got to break, is that sometimes there is no choice but violence.
Right.
You know, it may not be our first choice, but the only thing that's sometimes worse than you know, violence is not engaging in it. You know, I think of the couple that was, you know, raped and tortured and had their, you know, their daughter raped and burned, you know, up in New England a couple of years ago. There was something, in fact, worse than killing the bad guy. It's what everything that happened once they had surrendered to their mercy.
Right. And that's, you know, the concept of a fate worse than death, I don't think many people have that, and not like an actual idea of what it would be or what it looks like. But I guess my next question, or the next thing I'd like to talk about, and you sort of brought this up, but there seems to be a lot of misconceptions about, well, you won't have time, or your eyes can't actually physically focus on a front sight under stress. What are your thoughts on that?
So my thoughts is this. If you haven't prepared yourself to look at the front sight through, you know, training and making an emotional commitment to the front sight, then you're gonna struggle to look at the front sight under stress.
Right.
If, however, you've convinced yourself that within that front sight lies your salvation, it's going to hold a lot more appeal for you. So I think that, you know, the recency of your training, the last time you looked at your front sight, is certainly going to help. And there's probably, I think, a compelling issue argument to be made for maybe some equipment solutions to that as well, whether it's a red dot or one of the newer high-vis sights.
Right.
You know, there's been some interesting comments out there about how as soon as that, you know, big orange thing appeared in my vision, I remember I needed to focus on that, and then the problem went away when I was done. Or as I guess our friend Daryl Bulkey says, you know, put the front sight over the scary thing, and it'll go away.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like, too, that if, I mean, even historically, if we look back into the 70s when, you know, revolver companies started adding the orange plastic insert onto certain firearms front sights and hit rates dramatically increased. I mean, we've got a historical sort of basis for, hey, look, if you can see this thing, or at least if you, you know, if you make it higher visibility, it's easier to see this thing, and it sort of acts as its own reminder. But people don't talk about that much.
Well, it doesn't, you know, we go through these, I guess, trends and phases and stuff like that.
Sure.
You know, it was really, you know, we repeatedly see on, I don't know, if it's a 10-year cycle or 15-year cycle, this desire to push toward point shooting and stuff like that.
Right.
This also comes from a willingness of, you know, certain organizations, let's say law enforcement agencies in particular, to search for easy shortcut answers that maybe involve less training hours, less expenditure of ammunition, and they're basically still looking for the easy way out, not the way out that actually works. So there's plenty of evidence to me, you know, that there's clearly some people that have been able to see their front sight and use it to very good effect. So once somebody, you know, once we obviously can do it, we need to start to figure out what is special about those people. And when we look at those people, you know, we see a lot of training. We see a lot of, you know, very good level shooting, whether they're high-end competitors, they shoot very well in agency qualifications, that sort of stuff. So I think the people that use their front sight the best in practice are the ones that are going to be able to use the front sight when everything's flying about.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like, too, it's one of those things that, and I think that this cannot be overstated enough, but, and you said it at the beginning, if you have an emotional attachment to, for lack of a better term, the front sight, and Gabe White even mentioned this when he was on, and he mentioned it in training, like, you have to want the front sight worse than you have ever wanted anything before. And if you kind of approach it from that mindset, it seems to be there when you want it.
You know, it's very popular these days to poo-poo Jeff Cooper and, you know, completely ignore everything he contributed to our you know, our field. But
is it?
He very famously said, "Worship your front sight."
Huh.
You know, it is at the moment it could, you know, it is the most likely thing to deliver salvation in a crisis moment in which the gun is the answer.
Well, and you know, I can only go from my own personal experience, but the times in the past when I have needed a firearm very, very badly, the front sight was there. And I don't know if that's because I've spent so much time. Well, it's probably, I know it's because I've spent so much time working on it and all that. There's never been a time when I've, in training, not been looking for the sighting system, whatever that happened to be. But
when you keep your decision tree really pruned, most of us that are serious about this, is if a guy is beyond more than two arm's lengths, I'm looking for my front sight.
Right.
Well, that's a fairly easy thing to parse. You know, is he within two arm's length? Well, maybe I can do some kind of contact shooting, you know, from a two or a three, a la Craig Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, yeah, I'm going to try to visually index the weapon, get it up to eye level, and once it's up there, I can actually use those bumpy things.
Well, we got about 3 minutes left in this segment, but that kind of brings to mind an interesting thing. How able are we as humans to be able to contextualize, you know, so look at the situation that's unfolding in front of us, discard options that we would otherwise have and select from a much smaller pool of what we're capable of, you know, based off of the situation. Like, I've gone to class to do a lot of different things, but anything I've learned about aerial interdiction is probably I'm not going to consider in a street-level robbery, right?
I think that goes back to one of the concepts we mentioned earlier, that transition between the emotional mind and the rational mind.
Sure.
And one of the key drivers for the subconscious as far as which one it's going to keep in the game is this idea of a mental map, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the mental map is how you think reality will unfold around you. You know, the classic example is if you're hiking in the mountains and your map says there should be a great big valley in front of you and there's a great big mountain, well, we've got problems, right? But if those mental maps are matching up, then the rational mind is a lot more likely to stay in control. So as far as being able to parse options and stuff like that, that is where you have to do the work in advance. You have to be doing the visual imagery. You know, William April says that if your heart rate isn't changing when you're doing visualization, you're not doing it right. So ideally, in a perfect world, that's what our training does, is our training should, one of the most important things training can do, the second most important thing it can do, is help us create valid mental maps. So yeah, the valid mental map for Mookie and Ray Ray on an intercept course from you across the parking lot of the Stop and Rob probably isn't going to involve much aerial gunnery.
Right.
But hopefully you've got something filed away. You've got a little note card in the back of your mind that say, you know, Mookie and Ray Ray approach on, you know, Stop and Rob parking lot. This does not look good. Let me pull out this index card and see what it says.
Right.
Then you're going to be able to do all kinds of good stuff.
So you're saying the brain, even if it's got lots of options to choose from, sort of on its own will cut through some of them in about 60 seconds or less.
I think that it may be able to cut through some of them because it's always going to look for something relevant. But I think that you've got to train your brain very deliberately, you know, visualize the likely scenarios, see what I'm going to need to do to take care of those so that your brain doesn't have to sit there and flip through a bunch of information. You know, it's right there on top where I can grab it, you know, threat approaching, turn, let them know that I'm there, that sort of a thing. Have that, you know, option there ready to go. And it's, you've got to do the training of the brain in order for that to happen. It's not going to probably happen by accident.
Right. Well, and that seems to be something that a lot of people miss, too, is that hopefully if you're training, or you should be training, but hopefully it's all deliberate and hopefully it's all contextual and not not all over the place. But anyway, we have to go to break. So when we get back, more with John Hearn, and I'm going to let him pick between our last two possible topics. And you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. So we're talking with John Hearn, and we're already in the last segment, John, so this has gone really quick. And I know that your number one goal on coming on the show tonight was to make the internet mad. So I guess I'm going to leave it up to you. We've got a couple things that we could talk about. Do you want to cover the startle response or fine motor control, gross motor control?
Do I get to start?
Oh, man, that's a tough one.
we'll go after
startle reflex. Let's talk about fine and gross motor skills.
Okay.
Because that's alive and well. You hear it every day.
Yep.
I love you so hard.
Wow. Man, just creepy. What if his wife's listening?
I love her, too. She's amazing.
Anyway.
She lets me do this, so she is pretty amazing.
Yes. So many jokes, but I won't make any of them because I haven't gotten the FCC mad at me in a while, and I don't want to start now. So anyway, fine motor control versus gross motor control. What is the general internet argument that happens, just briefly, and then let's talk about why it's wrong.
Well, there's this whole idea that the only skills that you can access under high levels of stress are gross motor skills.
Sure.
And gross motor skills are large muscle actions, especially stuff that involves double appendage symmetry. So like squatting, I'm using both my legs, a bear hug with both my arms. That's a very gross motor skill. Fine motor skill is something that involves your hands, your fingers, more typically hand-eye coordination. And it's what we have to use to shoot a firearm accurately. So what people will sit there and say is that, well, you can only do these gross motor skills and anything, you know, for instance, like, you know, using the slide catch lever to drop the slide, will never happen under stress.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that, of course, is it ignores that we had to use fine motor skills to get the gun out of the holster, especially if you're a police officer and it was in a security rig. But just the act of pressing the trigger straight back without disturbing the sights is, in fact, a fairly, you know, fine motor skill in and of itself. So people seem very willing to, you know, kind of pick and choose which fine motor skills they can get to under stress. And, you know, the thing that drives me crazy is that if we actually dig into the definitions of these things, the classic example would be the slide catch lever, is a lot of times people are like, well, that's a fine motor skill. Well, by definition, if you're not using your eyes to do it, it probably isn't. When I drop the slide with the slide catch lever, I'm not looking at the lever. It's right there under my thumb where it has been, you know, however tens of thousands of repetitions it has before me. So as long as I'm using a similar platform where that lever is the same place, dropping the slide that way is not even a freaking fine motor skill.
Right.
It just isn't, period.
Well, so, and you kind of touched on it too, but generally if you have to hit something, especially if you have to hit something past, oh, I don't know, 21 feet, even 10 feet, or even 5 feet, a good trigger press goes into that, and that's, like you said, that's not a gross motor skill.
And I think we all know that if you try to, you know, beat the trigger like it's a borrowed field hand, nobody gets good results from that. So if we actually want to hit with the pistol, there is going to be some finesse you have to manage to put under the trigger, or else you end up dumping the whole magazine without hitting anything, which we also know is a possibility, just not a desirable one.
Right, right. And that seems to be something that, I don't know, I guess a lot of people are maybe turning the trigger press into a gross motor skill and with results to match. So, man, I think we have enough time. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more, or do you want to talk about the startle reflex or response?
Well, just real quickly, there's a whole lot of training systems out there
sure.
that are based on this idea of what we call the Landis Hunt crouch.
Okay.
And it's this whole idea that we automatically crouch, lower our chin to protect our throats, and our hand come up to defend the face and eyes. That's almost a direct quote.
Yeah.
And that comes from an old 1939 study. And a lot of guys have said, oh, we're going to do this every time, but we need to better to train from this position. Well, if you dig into how they did the study, you know, for instance, a fake, you know, a blank shot from behind, the fact that the person was seated when they did this, that reaction really isn't that startling. The problem is subsequent research, you know, post-1939, we now know that there's at least 30 unique startle responses. So if we're going to use the startle response as our natural response to a threat, which one of the 30 are you going to pick? I mean, a 1 in 30 chance just does not seem that great to me.
Right.
We also know that the startle response people deliver can actually depend on the emotional state that they're in. If it's like an inbound object, for instance, their hands may automatically move to intercept the object without any, you know, attempt of conscious thought of that. It just happens automatically. So using the startle reflex as the basis for your system just doesn't work out too well. A way to think of it is a crude analogy, but anytime you see a startle reflex, it's typically because the signal going into your brain exceeded the capacity to absorb it. And we can get startle reflex not just from loud noises. We can get it from bright lights. We can get it from postural instability, like I'm losing my balance and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there really is no monolithic startle response out there to base anything on. And we also know that in primates, there's some really good evidence out there that primates can actually wire in what is essentially a voluntary movement to the involuntary level if it confers enough survival advantage.
Okay.
So the point to me is we need to prepare our mind. We need to make the for lack of a better word, the amperage rating on the fuse that's going to kick out to get us to startle. We simply need to train to make sure that amp rating on that fuse is as high as we can have it. And then the startle reflex becomes a moot point because it's, you know, you're just not going to see it that much. And I think most of us who have been shooters and stuff like that, I mean, if you've ever been around a bunch of shooters and pop a shot timer, you'll see people start their draw strokes.
Well,
and
sometimes.
That's not one of the expected startle reflexes. Yet, obviously, these people, because they've done a lot of work, have wired that in. So any system that's based on just this raw startle reflex is not based in science. It's not bathed in science the way that they would have you think.
Well, and it's funny you mentioned that because, you know, I, as an instructor, one of the things that I hate to hear the most, especially maybe when I'm in front of the line, you know, we've got everyone in their holster, no one's supposed to do anything, blah, 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 is a shot timer go off when I'm in front of the line. It's like this it's this immediate, like, oh, Lord Jesus, please don't. Okay, good. We're good. Good.
No one did it.
Yeah. Yeah. But so we got a couple minutes left in the show before the outro music starts playing and all that. But what would you like to leave people with in that last couple of minutes? What do you want people to consider? And if people want to come train with you, maybe at a big big training event in 2019, how could they do that? And where could they do that?
So a couple of things. You really need to educate yourself about evil in the world. And I would say the two best sources for that, not necessarily for evil in the world, but for understanding it, would be Dr. William April for like a live lecture. His lectures are just simply outstanding. Every time I get a chance to listen to his same boring stuff, I always go and listen to it because I always pick up something.
Right.
And if you're a book person, there's an author by the name of Stanton Samanow that wrote a great book called Inside the Criminal Mind. It's on its third edition now. It's a little thick, but man, if you can get into that book, you really start to understand that criminals are, for all practical purposes, a different species from us. So if you were to take anything from this, just accept the fact that there's evil out there and educate yourself about it. As far as where I'm going to be and stuff like that, I'm going to be at Northeast Shooters, May 5th and 6th up in New Hampshire. I think that's neshooters.com for their website. We've got the Rangemaster Northwest Tactical Conference coming up in July out at Marty Hayes' Firearms Academy of Seattle. That's the end of July. And then I will be back for TACCON 2019 in the big easy, the big sleazy, whatever we call the city of New Orleans.
Well, and I'm super looking forward to TACCON. I mean, I look forward to it every year, but it just keeps getting better and better. I really enjoyed the match this last year. I'm looking forward to next year. And not many people know this, but you had a huge part in making the match go because you built all the targets, didn't you?
Yeah, that's the remnants of my failed business plan. I had this great idea to make targets that promote shooting excellence and then try to sell them to law enforcement agencies.
Uh-huh.
As a business plan, that really didn't work out. But the people that can really know how to shoot really enjoy them.
Nice, nice. Well, hey, John, I really appreciate you taking time out of your Sunday to join us. I'm also looking forward to seeing you in a week or so because we're going to be hanging out. But thanks again, man. Be safe. Talk to you soon.
Take care, guys.
All righty. Hey, make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. It helps us out a lot. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next week.